Hello and welcome to Fourth Estate, a show about journalism. We're coming to you from 2SER in Sydney on the lands of the Gadigal people, right across Australia on the Community Radio Network and directly to a device across the globe via podcast. I'm Anthony Dockrell. Here on Fourth Estate, disinformation and radicalisation are issues that have been at the heart of many of our discussions. While we've tended to focus on the role of the media in causing and possibly solving these problems, we've also wanted to understand the mechanism that causes people to become radicalised and why. It's fair to say many of us have struggled to understand the emergence of groups like QAnon and the anti-vaxxer movement in an age when trusted information is so readily available. It's also fair to say we live in a time of deep distrust built on media ecosystems that in places feeds into this distrust for financial and other reasons. A new article in the Journal of Sociology has unpacked and given a greater understanding of how people get indoctrinated and also how they might set themselves free from the tentacles of disinformation and conspiracy thinking. You may be surprised to find at times the answer isn't fact-checking or the media actively debunking these beliefs. The report is called Conspiracy, Misinformation, Radicalization, Understanding the Online Pathways to Indoctrination and Opportunities for Intervention. And we're fortunate to have two of the authors with us here on Fourth Estate. Emily Booth is a research assistant at the University of Technology Sydney, and Marion Andre Razou is an associate professor leading the Behavioural Data Science Lab at the University of Technology Sydney. Emily Booth and Marion Andre Razou, welcome to Fourth Estate.
Thank you for having us. It's good to be here.
Thank you.
It's true to say there's now greater awareness of conspiracy theories and disinformation, but it's also true to say that this greater awareness has not translated into a better understanding of the reasons why people fall into conspiracy theories. Before we get into your findings, I'd like to hear you both talk about the scale of the problem and what motivated you to do this research.
My motivations are actually quite personal. I have a close family that has been lured in the temptation of conspiracy theories. And then I have seen firsthand what that can do to them and what it did to the rest of the family. So that's why I set off to investigate this problem. And I was wondering if there's anything we can do about it. And this came on the backdrop of some of the research I've been doing for over a decade, where I was looking into how information travels in the online environment. So we've been building mathematical models at its core of understanding how information travels and how people get in touch with it, even things like why popularity emerges and who will be our influencers. So for me, connecting the dots was obvious. Using this type of methods and approaches, could we try to unpack why people get attracted and why they consume and they get increasingly hooked onto conspiracy theories and misinformation.
Emily, what was your motivation for doing this research?
In terms of doing the research, my background is in social sciences as well as literature and reading and that sort of thing. And when I had worked with Andre in the past, I started thinking about these conspiracies and misinformation pieces as narratives in the sense that they are stories that people get invested in, where they have characters and themes and sort of plotted events. So because I have a background in, you know, research that involves people, but also this kind of literature background, that was kind of what really caught my attention, was how are people engaging with this and how is it affecting them and thinking about, you know, as this sort of unusual alternative to perhaps reading a novel, traditional novel. But of course, it's a lot more dangerous when it involves real people. And yes, well, I work with Andre because he asked me to, and I love working with him. So that's it.
Now, it's common practice to blame the internet or social media for the woes of the world, but conspiracy theories have been around long before the internet and before the personal computer was invented, for that matter. Is blaming social media or the algorithms, et cetera, simply an oversimplification of the problem? Or is there something fundamentally different about our new online lives?
Indeed, conspiracy theories and even believing in all sorts of unreasonable, having all sorts of unreasonable beliefs is not new. However, the online did change things quite significantly. because it allowed a way that to information to travel further. So now, say back 50 years ago, you only had as an audience, as possible contacts, the people around you, your neighborhood, your city, or maybe even traveling to a bigger city close by, but that would be about it. So it would sort of restrain the amount of people that would be compatible with you, particularly on the more fringe topics. But with the online environment, it basically gave us access to everyone in near real time. So now, no matter how fringe my ideas are, I will almost certainly always find at least one group of people that would share them with me. And now we need to think about how people are organized sociologically and psychologically. We do tend to surround ourselves with people that resemble us, you know, the famous birds of a feather flock together. And once we start emerging ourselves in this type of information groups, a couple of interesting phenomena happen. And two of them are filter bubbles and echo chambers. Filter bubbles say that the amount that the information that gets filtered to us via these groups tends to be biased towards the view of the groups. So say a group that has a particular set of worldviews will only push information with that type of worldviews to its members. So it sort of curates the diet. Echo chambers means that in such groups, when you utter opinions, no matter how fringe or outrageous they would seem for everyone else, because those people are similar to the individuals in question, it means that they will agree with them, therefore creating a false consensus, which means that whenever we immerse ourselves in these groups, we tend to lose context and grip with reality because we start thinking that everyone thinks like us and then all the information is according to our worldviews. So while the phenomena are not new, the conduits of information are new and allow us access to people like us from all around the world. And if you add on top of it the recommender engines of the platforms, whose purpose is to maximize engagement, irrespective of what they recommend, those augment the problem even more.
Now, your article in the Journal of Sociology states that the radicalization process is driven by emotions and not information. I thought this was a really interesting point. Can you explain what you mean by that?
Yes. So the way of doing the research in brief was we had 27 published news reports or interviews with people who had come forward and said they were previously part of such communities and spoken about their experiences. And then we had 20 posts gathered from online in line with our university ethics approval, where people were describing similar situations. And 20 posts might not sound like a lot, but these tended to be very long posts because people were recounting a very detailed journey. And in none of those that I read did I see that people were being brought into a fringe community or being prompted to look into it necessarily because of information. They might have had an initial query about something such as vaccines, but the reason that they become invested is because that community that they end up as a part of is providing the emotional support needs that they are not getting for their views and for their sometimes very genuine worries from the people around them, from their existing social network. So if you're someone who starts out with just a little bit of nervousness about, you know, the COVID vaccine and, you know, you're feeling like, don't these things normally take such a long time to develop? How is it so quick this time? Maybe it's not as safe and perhaps you're not aware that the reason these vaccines were faster was simply because the researchers had the money thrown to them rather than them having to apply for grants through typical processes. Then, of course, you might start to wonder a little bit about, you know, why was it so fast? Are they still as safe? Have they been through the proper checks? And perhaps saying that to your friends and family that you already have, they'll be like, what do you mean? It's already been licensed and approved. It's fine. Don't be ridiculous. Don't be so silly. I can't believe you would say something like that. And so that person is going to feel humiliated and feel like they're, again, probably at the start, like a bit of an initial concern. They're going to feel like that has been completely dismissed and like they've been made to feel ashamed for wanting to think about the topic. And so they'll end up retreating to the place that will give them that comfort and support.
Now, distrust is the vital ingredient, and it's fair to say that distrust is now a currency in many of our online spaces, and it's baked into many of our debates and the narratives around, around many of the things that we're talking about online. It's also in parts of the mainstream media, it has to be said. Are many of us primed for conspiratorial thinking, even though we don't know it?
Then the proof for the answer for this question is just circumstantial from what we've seen. We don't necessarily have any clear proof for it. It is true that maybe some of us would be more psychologically we'll be more inclined to believe such conspiratorial talk. But I would say that the accent of what is being changing is really the way we structure both our online interactions, but also our sources of information. You mentioned that the media has a role in pushing mistrust. Well, let's not forget that the media today is not what the media used to be even 10, 20 years ago. The advent on the online, they actually changed quite fundamentally the structure of the media corporations and the newspapers by altering their funding revenue. People just don't read. They just don't read the print media anymore. They will be getting their information diet from online social media. In fact, it's been shown that even 5 years ago, most adults, up to 80% of the adults, will consume news that is shared via social media. So this already introduces bias. Remember how I was talking about the filter bubble, which filters the information that is being fed. So if we always consume the information from a biased source, then we are bound to form a biased representation of the world, which then you corroborate this on top of the defunding of the traditional media due to the loss of advertising funding and needing to restructure and merging, which makes media more concentrated and more aligned with the worldviews of a handful of people. This is a very complex phenomenon that's been taking place slowly over the, I would say, past 10, 15, 20 years, which got us to the current point. So it is essentially a diet. This is a problem of the informational diet. And as Emily said, when we started this project, we started looking at misinformation, and we thought that the clue was in the title, information. So we actually started by looking at the content of the news media that is being published and produced in Australia. And we looked at the media, at the very representative sample of the media from multiple points of view: their bias, their political bias, their skewedness, their clickbaitiness, the information completeness. We've done a lot of work on this, but particularly on the information completeness, what we couldn't find was a significant difference from what you would call, reputable news sources and the more fringe style news sources. In essence, a media outlet will have a pretty decent representation of what happens in the world. And almost all media outlets have pretty good representation of what happens in the world, despite their bias. The perceived bias is there. Where we did find a huge difference is in the curated feeds from the fringe groups that we were following. So it's not about the information that is being produced, which is more instilling fear or biasing us, but it's rather the curation that takes place within the midst of these communities. It's just some types of information make it more to the members than others.
So your article talks about the stages that people go through on their journey into radicalization. Emily's sort of already unpacked that early stage. Initially, people feel, positive feelings when they're in this stage. Can you unpack those feelings, Emily, and talk about whether they last?
Yeah, so this is a really interesting question. I think it depends on whether people get out. So for a lot of the accounts that we looked at for these kind of intermediate stages that you might describe, there were a lot of descriptions of feeling euphoric, feeling like they had control of the world, feeling like they had found their people, the people who finally understood them and were their sort of true found family almost, and just people feeling like they suddenly were able to be in charge of their own lives, because they it gave them reassurance about not only their initial concerns, but it gave them the idea that they could participate in changing things, sort of quote unquote, for the better, to be in line with their views. What we noticed from people who withdrew at the intermediate stages, which I should say was the majority of the participants in our study, so kind of at the end of what we call like a stage four, is that something changed. So for some, it was people suddenly realized that they were lurching between periods of euphoria and perhaps extreme depression about the content they were being exposed to and the ideas and what it suggested about the world, and the fact that a fundamental principle of a lot of these theories is you can't trust your fellow humans, you can't trust the people you elect to safeguard your interests, you know, you can't trust your neighbors anymore or your family or friends. And people also had health consequences in terms of getting less physical activity being one of them, changes to their diet, major disruptions to their sleep patterns, which is significant because sleep is the process by which our brain processes negative feelings, basically, and you need to get that 8 hours for that to go through. And if you're not sleeping plenty, then those bad feelings are going to progressively accumulate. You know, your brain can't bring around its mental garbage truck to sort of sweep out some of that mess that otherwise accumulates, if that metaphor makes sense. And so this sort of plummet could in some cases trigger people to be aware of their current situation and decide to make changes. In the people who went a bit further, you know, sometimes there were very tragic consequences there. And so even if they were suffering all of these things, the thing that might be significant to them was the euphoria. So a lot of people described this investment in the communities and the narratives there as feeling like they're on a drug and they need a progressively stronger and stronger hit.
Andre, we've heard this initial stage. What's the middle stage? What's the next stage that a lot of people find themselves in?
So after the initial stages of confusion and then reaching back to the old sources of authority, so these would be the initial stages. And particularly if in these initial stages they receive a scalding response and they retreat back to the communities, then we move into what we would call the third stage. So the middle stages would be stages 3 and 4 out of the six stages of our model. In these stages, people get increasingly connected to their source to their newfound communities, where they get this euphoric sentiment, and they disconnect more from their old sources of information. They disconnect from their old lives. They start disconnecting from their family, their friends, their circle. They stop doing what they want to do. But what is a big difference at the evolution of the stages is that they move from a passive consumers of information, where they just say consume the information which is being peddled within these groups. They move to be active, either producers or active propagators of the information. So it means that now they start to be actively engaged in the groups. They start to be moderators. They start to push, to organize, to discuss. But they move from being passive consumers to active, and that starts taking all of their space and headspace. It is noteworthy that our work and our project not only looked into the stages of this transformation, but it also looked into what are possible intervention points and what are our exit ramps. So intervention points is things that we could do either as a society or as a family or just the close people if we're talking about the loved ones, but in any of these stages. And the exit ramps would be how people got out. And this is what Emily's main focuses when studying the interview, studying our data. So the intervention, in terms of interventions, they also get increasingly difficult. So if in the first stages, just properly designed communication campaigns could do the trick in stage one. So just informing people, what we would call debunking. In stage two, you would need just compassionate responses from the experts that these people reach out to. So if the friend and family or the GP or the social authority doesn't answer with a scalding answer, but instead acts compassionate and starts to unpack the information, then that is a very good intervention. As we progress into the middle stages, the avenues for interventions actually decrease quite significantly. At some point, organized and outside communications will stop working completely. So say governmental or official agencies' communications, they don't really work. Experts, they are no longer trusted. They don't trust us, academics. They especially don't trust us because they think we are paid by the government to say whatever needs to be said. What does tend to work at these middle stages is the feedback and responses for people within the community or people that they respect. So either people that are role models in these communities or formers that got out of the radicalization. So that's what the intervention path is. In terms of the exit ramps, what we noticed is that in these middle stages, it's also getting increasingly difficult to exit. And most of the people that did exit was due to a big event in their life, either a death of a family member or a significant event, which started putting things into context and starting raising questions. These questions, they essentially lead to them questioning actually the truthfulness of what they are believing and what they are engaged with. So these will be the middle stages.
And look, it's very interesting you're talking about those exit ramps. And it does make sense, even though it is a little bit depressing to think that fact-checking, debunking, education programs pushed by government or in the media aren't going to reach people who are in these middle stages. What's the final stage that people can move to?
Yeah, so for our final stages, when we were preparing for this research, we had of course, a kind of scholarly literature review where I was looking through previous existing models that looked at radicalization. But one of the challenges that we had with our work that we were looking at and the existing models was that they were extremely context specific. So they related to things like explicit terrorist groups or very fringe militarized religious groups and things or sort of gangs and that sort of thing. They didn't actually reflect this kind of new type of radicalization, this kind of self-radicalization that is almost happening online. So when we're talking about our kind of final stages, it's a bit different to the existing models, which suggest that it is things like committing terrorist attacks. So for us in our penultimate stage, we have quite publicly visible erratic behavior. So we had a couple of examples of this with people behaving very publicly, but sort of destructively in a way that was like they were starting to try and almost take a stand for their cause in the public. And these weren't necessarily violent examples. They could be things like vandalizing stands of masks, for example, in shopping centers because they thought COVID was a conspiracy and that sort of thing, as well as sort of more brutally sort of cutting off their family around them. And this is sort of when we saw that sort of flipped also to a more depressed kind of experience that I mentioned previously. And then the sort of final stage is when we would get to actually committing harm. So doing something that causes material harm to another person. So as distinct from emotional harm, which is, of course, very significant, this is where people are making decisions that could impact the physical well-being of another person. So you see that in examples like, you know, everything from like QAnon supporters going to kind of storm the Capitol to people engaging in, you know, acts of violence that they were participating in their area, sort of against individuals that they decided to target, to even I think the decision of a parent to withhold from their child what are normally mandatory and ordinary vaccines against highly preventable diseases, which does endanger that child's life. It is an extreme decision to be made, and it endangers the life of the other children around them and eventually the other adults. So there are kind of extreme stages there, and they could manifest in a sort of variety of different ways.
And your article states that final stage, very few people make that stage. But when you look at something like QAnon, you know, the storming of the Capitol, there was a lot of people there. So is people in those middle stages able to get caught up it with people in the final stage? Is that something that, I guess, are those lines a bit blurred at times?
I think there were certainly a lot of people involved in the Capitol building incident in the US, but that is such a tiny amount of what we can see of the sheer spread of things like QAnon online. The actual amount of people that are involved in that space is just astronomical, and it's global. It has crossed languages, so it's also in other countries than America, for example. And just because people were not physically storming it, I don't think that's the indicator of the, I don't think that indicates the sort of widespread nature of these.
Well, look, final question. For people listening who might find themselves flirting with these ideas or worried that they might be susceptible or just worried about a loved one, what advice would you both give those people?
Yeah, so if you're concerned about yourself, I would say log off whatever is exposing you to that situation and pick up a book. So this kind of comes back to my point about the narrative appeal of some of these stories. Also, reading on a screen and reading on paper are not equal activities. They are actually like apples and oranges. When you read on paper, your brain is able to more deeply comprehend the text, more deeply able to empathize with what you're reading, and more able to remember it and more able to critically reflect on it. The fact that these are all impeded when you read on a screen, I think, is actually probably a factor that continues to the spread of these ideas, because literally no one can properly read it. There is considerable body of research on the role that the medium plays of screen reading and how it changes these things. So I think filling that same desire that you have for narrative in reading a book enhances all of these abilities in you to have empathy, to reconcile different perspectives, to critically reflect. And it will also fill some of the time. So think about whether you're really enjoying scrolling through social media and reading those posts. Like, is that actually fun, or is it just sort of better than doing nothing? So that's actually what I would say is one of the strong antidotes. Of course, also, if you have particular concerns about a topic, making sure that you reach out to qualified professionals in the area, such as doctors and nurses. And if you are finding issues with your doctor where you're just not getting the explanation you need, perhaps even seeking out another doctor in the same practice that might have a personality that fits you better, because sometimes there are just simply different styles of doctors who don't feel the need to explain everything to their patient, and that can come off as like a bit confronting if you're someone who actually wants to be informed of the process. I know this because I'm one of those people. And when it comes to a loved one, I would say that the recommendations we have are really that sort of empathetic response when someone voices something. And then I would say trying to understand it. So that can be quite simple things like asking why they feel that way. And I think at the end of, if you kind of go through that process, oh, well, why are you really worried about the vaccines? You know, why are you concerned that there is this issue with government? You know, what is it that you're actually concerned about? Often you'll come right down and find that the core issue is something completely unrelated.
I'd like to thank you both for a great discussion. The research is very important. It's hopefully going to lead to a better understanding and better, I guess, treatments and processes for dealing with this problem, which is a very serious problem facing the world, and especially in this year, which is an election year in America. So I'd like to thank Emily Booth and Marianne-Andre Razou for being on Fourth Estate.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you very much.
And thanks for listening to the program. This edition was recorded at the studios of 2SER and heard across the country on the Community Radio Network. Fourth Estate is produced with the assistance of the Community Broadcasting Foundation. Thanks to the Foundation for their continuing support. Make sure you subscribe to Fourth Estate on your favourite podcast app so you can hear us talk about media, politics, and a lot in between. We'll be back with more next week, but in the meantime, you can stay in touch with us on Twitter. Our handle is Fourth Estate AU. I'm Anthony Dockrell. Thanks for listening.